Hello and welcome to We the People for what I truly believe could be one of our most important shows. We're discussing the findings of a book, a New York Times bestseller, a book that I found incredibly hard to stomach. As a parent, I've read this book and I'm filled with dread and millions of questions. What medication are we giving our children? Do they work? What's in them? Will it do more harm to them than good? And today, as a journalist, I want to find answers to these questions on your behalf, because this is an issue that affects each and every one of us. There's nobody in this country who has not, at one point of time or the other in their lives, had to take or will need to take medication. So this show tonight is about you. On the show, we have Catherine Evans. She is the award-winning author of Bottle of Lies. She joins us from New York. We have Dinesh Thakur. He is the former director and global head of research information and portfolio management at Radbaxi Laboratories. He is the whistleblower in the Radbaxi case. He is a key source in the Book of Lies. He is now a public health activist, and he focuses on improving the quality of affordable medicines for all. We have joining us today representing the pharma industry, we have Harinder Sikka. He is the group director of the Piramal Group. We have Lina Meghani. She is a lawyer at the Access Campaign at Medicine Sans Frontier. That is the international organization that works on providing access to medicines for the poor in the developing world. And we have Dinesh Dua also joining us, chairman of the Pharmaceuticals Export Promotion Council of PharmExcel. And first and foremost, I want to make one thing clear. In the interest of time, also, I want to focus today's discussion on the Indian consumer. Now, a majority of this book is dedicated to the Ranbaxy cover-up and on pharma companies who were answerable to the U.S. Food and Drug Authority or the FDA because they were exporting medicines for the U.S. market for American patients. But I want to focus on the Indian patient. What does this mean for Indian pharma? We're asking tonight, was Ranbaxy a one-off, a bad apple, one rogue company, or is this an industry-specific problem? Is the problem a lack of quality controls? Is it more systemic? Is it ingrained? Catherine Evans, first to you, Bottle of Lies makes some startling claims. All of you here are experts, but I'm going to speak in simple terms for the layman. And, you know, you all may be or have been aware of this, but for me, the biggest revelation was that, according to your book, some of the biggest pharma companies in India were slash today are still making different qualities of the same medicine. According to your book, the ones with the highest efficacy go to developed countries like the US and Europe, and the rest are sold to people like me and all of our audience here in countries like India, in African countries, and in the third world because we have a weak regulation.
You know, Sarah, your question, was Ranbaxy an outlier or the tip of the iceberg, is exactly what I set out to answer when I reported this book. I wanted to know, is this simply one of the most corrupt drug companies in the world, or is there something about what Ranbaxy did that is how the industry works? And I, one of the more troubling findings in my reporting was that companies routinely engage in what they call dual track production. So this is, they make one level of quality for the most developed countries, but another and lower level of quality for developing countries with less regulation. The reason they do that, as I found, and as whistleblowers told me, is it's what they can get away with, that the more weak the regulations, the lower the quality, which is a manufacturing standard that amounts to, you know, whatever you can get away with. And the consequence of that is that the poorest quality medicine is going to what they call ROW markets, rest of world markets. That's Africa, and it includes India as well. And I think for the Indian consumer, it means there's no doubt that they are getting lower quality medicine than is being shipped to Europe, to the US. I think it's very sad.
So, of course, readers would want, and critics of the book would want, would ask for proof of this. In India, we know we don't like to waste anything. You know, two pairs of the same flip-flops on the same foot will be used again by somebody, whether it's a beggar on the road. Nothing is thrown away. Unfortunately, what you have said in your book is that this wonderful habit is ingrained in Indian pharma too. You have cited a case of Wockhardt where a batch of medicines were found to be contaminated with black particles. You then say that FDA inspectors said this was no good for the American market. It must be destroyed, but those medicines were then released in India in the Middle East. So for you, you base this book on FDA reports and inspection reports. For
That's
you,
right.
you say the first
That's right.
red flag was the fact that there was rarely a rejected batch.
Right. So FDA investigators were going over to Indian drug plants and discovering that there was rarely a batch that was discarded. Instead, they would always be able to find a market where they could sell it. And proof of this, as you've asked, where's the proof, is documented in FDA inspection reports. Investigators would go in. They would see, for example, improperly sealed vials that were subject to contamination. They would ask, where is this going? And the answer was to ROW markets.
All right, we have Kiran Majumdar-Shaw, chairperson and managing director of Biocon, joining us. Kiran, Catherine Ebbin saying that this is Ranbaxy was not a one-off. It is, in fact, the dark side of Indian pharma that has been exposed. Your reaction?
Well, I think Catherine has exposed some facts of the Indian pharma industry, but I think she should have balanced it with the good and the bad. I think she's, you know, too one-sided in her assessment of the Indian industry, and she's basically tarnishing the entire sector, which I don't agree with. I think Indian industry has some bad apples, but I think we also have companies that are really focusing a lot on quality systems and are trying to really make sure that they are world-class in every way. So I think she needs to appreciate that.
Okay. But Kiran, let me ask you, a large part of this book also focuses on FDA inspections. In India, over the last 20 years, as we've celebrated in the media also this great Indian story of the generic pharma industry, we've talked about and given great applause to companies that have gotten FDA clearance or go ahead from the gold standard when it comes to accountability and quality controls. But in this book, it emerges that the FDA inspections, for example, were all taking place with prior intimation to these companies, which creates this ridiculous situation where you're opening up a Pandora's box with, of course, anyone who may want to skirt the law will, you know, it's low-hanging fruit. They're like, why not?
I think that's highly exaggerated. I think you should understand that FDA inspections are very thorough. In fact, I think what Catherine does not bring out in her book is the fact that if you look at US FDA inspections and the outcomes of those inspections, they also have a large number of non-compliance issues in the US as well. Mm. I think they also have a large number of warning letters as well. Mm. I think, you know, you must put it into perspective. I think US FDA is obviously very concerned with meticulous standards, meticulous systems. Of course, as long as you have systems which are manual and those which involve human intervention, there are going to be human errors. I think most companies are now trying to move to an electronic format, and you're likely to see less human errors. I mean, you know, US FDA is so picky when it comes to how people enter dates, and if they by mistake enter the wrong date, it's considered to be data integrity. These are the kind of things that, you know, people are making as human errors, and some of them might be genuine, some of them might be deliberate, but I think there is no way to know the difference today. Because, when you have human errors, you have to be, you know, is it subjective or not is the question. So I think these are some of the issues that we will only get resolved with technology. And I think Indian companies are up to it. Indian companies are investing heavily in technology. Hmm. And I think in the next few years, you will actually see a huge boost in the quality systems and the adherence to compliance, only because they have now technology that can prevent these human errors.
Technology is on their side. Catherine, please respond here, to the charge that your book isn't balanced. For example, out of the more than 12,000 FDA inspections of drug plants in the United States, 15% were uncovered violations of the FDA's data integrity rules, right? In India, we're saying it's 25% of the plants inspected. In China, maybe 35%. Why have, or could you, should you have put this into context and talked about how similarly in the U.S., there are many that don't pass these FDA inspections?
Well, first of all, one question I would have for Ms. Shaw is whether she's read the book in its entirety, because I dedicate at least two chapters to what is really a golden hour for Indian pharma, which was a very heroic effort to get HIV/AIDS drugs low enough that they could treat African patients. What I also do is look very critically at the FDA's own investigation system and inspection system. Part of the problem here is that FDA investigators are telling Indian companies in advance that they're coming. They don't do that with the US companies, but they give overseas drug plants months of advance notice that they're coming. When the FDA did a limited experiment for a year and a half to do unannounced inspections, they found that the rate of very serious findings went up almost 60%. And, you know, regarding the question of whether the problems that they found are human error versus outright fraud, the kind of things they are uncovered were plants literally faking in entirety all of their microbiological environmental monitoring data. So they would be not testing any samples, but inventing data as though they had. Of course, human error occurs all the time. That is, you know, that is life, and everybody tries to improve upon that. I think the concern here is outright fraud, an effort to deceive regulators and pass off failing or substandard drugs as legitimate.
But Catherine, quickly, I just want to understand one thing. Mm-hmm. If increasingly over the years we're seeing that larger percentages, larger parts of America's drugs are mm-hmm. coming from outside its borders, yeah. increasingly from mm-hmm. India, would it not be obvious or normal to expect that the largest number of violations are also coming from India?
Yeah, I mean, when I've looked at percentages, so not just raw numbers, but percentages, an analysis I recently did that was published in Stat News so showed that the percentages of very serious findings that indicate fraud are quite a bit larger in India and larger even in China and lower in the U.S. and Europe.
Helena Sikka, please come in over here. The dark side of the Indian pharma industry exposed. Kiran Majumdar Shaw saying there that Catherine Eben is generalizing.
Well, it is true, Catherine. It is so easy to paint everything by the same brush. You know, trillions of dollars were made in the past in the U.S. alone when you raise the parameters of diagnostic parameters, and therefore, by just tweaking one number, you made millions of people sick when they were healthy. Just isolated news here and there. You know, when you're working for life-saving drugs, the Schedule M compliance in India is becoming tighter and tighter. People must understand that this is just 70-year-old country.
But you're not disputing what happened at Ranbaxy, right? That is something it's above debate.
They have
pled guilty in a U.S. court.
Correct. It happens everywhere.
Okay.
It happens in every industry. Okay. There will be black apple, okay. There will be black sheep,
okay.
And
so
there will be people who will be... But you paint everybody by the same brush.
My question to you then would be, is that if Catherine Eben is generalizing here, Ranbaxy was the gold standard, it was the flag bearer of the industry, would not most normal people think that if this is happening at the flag bearer of the industry, then what else must be happening elsewhere? And any journalist would then say, okay, and I should follow these leads and, you know, back it up with facts.
So what happened with Ranbaxy? For a very long period, they maintained that gold standard. Till Dr. Parvinder Singh was on the helm, it was a gold standard company.
Right at the beginning, was the...
No, then came his deputy. It remained certain till a very long time. Then something happened, which Dinesh will tell you better, what went wrong and how. But when it went wrong, it got caught and it became zero. That fear of Damocles sword hanging on a company and the losses thereof are far too many. Please, Catherine must understand, if India could bring down the cost of HIV, for example, drug, from $30 per day to 30 odd cents per day, we've saved a million or billion people, as the number may be, right? When the life-saving drugs are required at affordable prices, then the color of market, black or white, it does not matter. People will buy that drug come what may. The cost must have to be brought down.
The cost must come down, but are you getting what you're paying for, even at a lower cost? But Dinesh Thakur, Mr. Sikka, in a nutshell, wrapped up what actually happened with you at Ranbaxy, but he made it sound like it was very easy for you to flag what was going on at Ranbaxy, and you became a whistleblower. You first reported the fraud in 2005. And in 2008, the FDA had approved at least 27 other drugs made by Ranbaxy. That confounded you as a whistleblower, right?
It did. The point here is this. I can rehash the Ranbaxy story for you. It's not going to be useful. People can
even
read
that
the book,
is
right?
It's open. It's public
it
record.
Is.
We don't need to get into that now.
Here is the question that I'm asking, right? And I'm sure Lena will probably have a very different view on it. I've been working in this space, especially the India-US space, for over 15 years right now. Right, and I've seen this inside out. I'm not an advocate for branded drugs. I'm not an advocate for expensive drugs. I speak for good quality generic drugs. And here is my problem. My problem is this, right? When we make a generic copy of a branded drug, anybody who comes from a chemistry background will know that in order for that to be effective in your body when you take it, there has to be a certain concentration of that drug in your body, right? Why does a doctor say, take, you know, if you have an infection, you said you could have an infection,
mg.
Right? Take it twice a day. Why twice a day? Why not five times a day? Because there has to be a certain amount of concentration of that medicine in your blood, right? There are standards for that. Our regulation in India is larger than what is accepted internationally. What the international regulation says, the standard for bioequivalence is plus or minus 20%. Okay? 20% below to 15% higher. Our guidelines in this country say that a drug is a generic equivalent copy if we have 30% variance on both sides. Now, why does it matter to us, right? If you're taking a drug that is a broad-spectrum antibiotic. You know, if you get a bacterial infection, you take a broad-spectrum antibiotic, it basically kills what the pathogen is in your body. But if you take a drug that is what are called narrow therapeutic dosage drugs, thyroid medication, anything to do with mental health, women here, hormonal medication, these are very tightly titrated. Little variance here and there will make a huge difference in the way the therapeutic benefit is offered to you. Our problem is our regulations. He speaks about Schedule M. Schedule M is so underplayed compared to international standards for good manufacturing practices that we're not even in the same ballpark. Forget about the same plane. Number one. Number two, I'll just conclude my remarks by just saying this one quick thing, and we'll go back and talk about this. This is a page that I got printed out today. This is from a report, and it's available out here. You know, you can go look it up. We have in the parliament, we have what are called standing committees.
Correct.
Right? These are members of parliaments who look at various aspects of, you know, all of our things that are happening in the country. We have one for IT. They're looking at the data protection law right now. Sure. This is a report, 59th Parliamentary Standing Committee report, issued by Rajya Sabha in 2012. Well, let me read this one paragraph, if you just indulge me for a second. It says the committee is of the view that the responsibility needs to be fixed for the unlawful approval of buclizine, a drug hardly of any consequence to public health in India, and is being administered in babies and children. You know what this drug is for? This drug is sold as an appetite stimulant for children. There is zero clinical evidence for
this. Mr. Thakur here is saying the problem is one of regulation. My question would just be, we have substantial evidence, you're not refuting that, of action taken by the FDA against Ranbaxy and the medicines that it was being that it was producing. How come there was no action, nothing being heard about the Central Drug Standard and Control Association organization, right? That's the Indian equivalent of the NDA, FDA, about the same medicines. Is that worrying? Should the public, the Aam Aadmi, be worried that the FDA is saying that these medicines that Ranbaxy is making, there's a problem with them, but the Indian FDA is not saying anything?
You are expecting too much too soon. We became IPR compliant 1st of January 2005.
I think people are taking medication because they themselves or their loved ones are facing a life or death
situation.
To you. So I don't think anybody is expecting anything too soon. We're talking about lives, sir.
In 2017-18, when the drug tests conducted by the authorities, they found only 3% which were down the standards.
Correct.
And people and the companies had to pay a huge price for it. It's you want to check any country, I'll find you N number of flaws into it. A car industry recently in the US found the airbags weren't working. Millions of cars were withdrawn back.
Okay.
Now these errors will take place because they're meant to take place because no human system is ever perfect. You don't have a rocket going up the air and that is perfect. But to say that everything is failing here or everything is off the track, you have so many crams in India. The contract manufacturing, Amgen, the world's largest eye care companies, drugs are manufactured in India. You have multinational companies like Abbott operating without a flaw.
Catherine Hepburn, what Big Pharma is saying here to buttress their case is that despite this history of frauds, despite what we've seen at Ranbaxy, despite the experience of European companies and the Europe FDA equivalent, neither the US nor Europe has ostracized Indian drugs and Indian drug companies. Surely if things were so bad, Indian pharma they're pointing out, then, you know, they would.
Well, first of all, there's several issues here. One is nobody is saying everything is wrong. And I think we are all in agreement that Indian generics are crucial for public health throughout the world. But the question is, how to ensure that they are meeting the right quality? How to ensure that the companies are not taking all kinds of shortcuts and deceptive actions in order to increase profits, regardless of public health? And how can we ensure that Indian regulators are doing the job that they were set up to do? And, you know, mind you, our regulators aren't perfect either. And my book is extremely critical of the U.S. FDA as well.
Correct.
But it is abundantly clear that when flaws and deceptions and frauds in Indian generic companies are pointed out, Indian regulators have not taken the position of wanting to investigate further. They've taken the position of criticizing the messenger. So, for example, with my book, they did a brief perusal of it, in their own words, and concluded that it was fiction-filled stories, despite 40 pages of endnotes, 20,000 internal FDA documents. So their position seems to be one of protecting the industry,
correct,
rather than protecting.
So this was the CDS CEO you're saying when they were told, asked by the health ministry about the charges made in your book, they said they briefly perused it. It was that important that they only needed to briefly peruse it, and then they said it was all fiction. They've called it a piece of fiction. Dinesh Dua, please come in over here. Catherine is saying the Indian authorities, Indian organizations, regulators are not interested in pursuing this further. It is easier for them to, you know, shoot the messenger, to brand her as anti-national. What the CDSCO has said, this is Big Pharma trying to attack the Indian pharma industry, and the Indian public really wants to know which one is true. The PharmaCell has put out a statement saying that the pharma industry has been unfairly targeted in this book. Why do you say that?
Thank you, Sarah, for getting me on your channel for this very stimulating panel discussion. It's indeed acutely required because of the controversy that this book has generated. At the outset, let me state unequivocally that this book by Catherine, Bottle of Lies, should actually be Book of Lies. And I have statistical reasons to say what I'm saying. I'll come to
Please
your questions
them,
a little
Please
later.
Share them. We want
First
the
of all, there's been flawed interpretations based on interviews. Look, there's no data. It's just qualitative interviews and generic statements. And it's been dramatized and kind of sensationalized. And as the earlier panelists have spoken, that we are painting everything with the same brush. You know, kind of based on whatever you have seen in case of two or three companies where things have really happened and there have been admissions, right? You cannot say that India is as bad as this book, you know, sort of paints the picture. And as Catherine says what she says. Let me make it very clear that in 2019, the U.S. pharma companies received 54 warning letters. I repeat, 54 warning letters, as against India, which received only 17. And more so because India controls 40% by volume of the generic space in the United States. You see, Schedule M, which Mr. Sikka mentioned a little earlier, if you study it very carefully, and I've done that, and I invite Catherine and a few specialists to go through that, it's a wonderful combination of US FDA, European FDA, European authorities, as well as Japanese FDA, combination of rules and regulations. And there are a lot of experts who say very clearly that if Schedule M is compared to all of these put together, the quality standards in India, if not better, are equivalent to all of these regulated markets, stringent agencies. Now, insofar as you know, the CDSCO, which is a central agency equivalent to US FDA, as well as Ministry of Health and Family Welfare is concerned, they consulted all the stakeholders on this book. This book has been read millions of times by all of us in the industry because it's a question of the industry facing such allegations which are unsubstantiated, which have no database. It's based on the likes of Dinesh Thakur, and I don't want to mention anything beyond that as far as he was concerned. Today, I'm a very proud Indian to say that we supply, you know, generic, high-quality, very affordable medicines in 206 out of 211 countries. We control close to about 26% in volume of the global space. And you've heard about staggering numbers of supplying good-quality vaccines as well as ARV medicines and whole host of others to WHO as well as to UNICEF.
Okay, so India is the largest provider of generic drugs in the world. Nobody is disputing that, which is why this is such an important story. Is this time for introspection for the pharma industry? Then Dinesh, respond over there, because what the pharma industry is saying is two things. One, in its defense, they're like, look, we are the largest providers of generics in the world. Now, if this were true, why would people be buying from us? That's one. And two, what they're basically saying is that Indian generic brands are just about as safe or as effective as brand drug counterparts mm-hmm. in the US. So what we're saying is we're not admitting we're bad mm-hmm. or we're good. We're saying we're just about as good or as bad as you have in the US. Yeah. So what would you respond?
So I don't think there's any dispute at all that India actually supplies a very vast majority of generic drugs, not only in the US, yes. but also to Europe and to other countries all over the world. There's no dispute about that. There's also no dispute about the fact that if you take medicines which act in a broad way, like antibiotics, right, variations in efficacy doesn't really translate into problems because it essentially addresses the pathogen load, for example, if you take an antibiotic. However, if you have medicines that are extended release, if they are medicines that are narrow therapeutic dosage drugs.
Sure, but the charge here, this is not India specific. It is unfair to say this is an India problem.
Because the reason why I'm saying this is because you can't argue both ways, right? You can't argue to say that we make the largest amount of drugs consumed globally, right? But again, on the same hand, say it's not an India problem. You pick one of those two arguments,
Got it.
Say, look, we do this, right? And we supply all of this. Now, you asked me two questions. That was the first question. The second question is, why aren't more healthcare providers being aware of this? It is changing. There are people I know of that I work with that are systematically documenting issues with poor quality drugs. The research is now beginning. We are beginning to move away from anecdotes to specifically scientifically designed studies to understand what the impact is.
I would like to come in.
Go ahead, Mr. Sikka.
What he's saying is, right, they've woken up now and they're doing their so-called methodological checks and balances. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's so easy to paint everybody with the same brush. It's that statement that you make and earn that wow value when you actually have done no research. You tarnish Indian companies, and that is what multinationals overseas sometimes want.
Okay, so you've made that
so
point.
So whose part are you playing?
Tarnishing of Indian companies and the Indian pharma industry. But Leena Meghani, please come in over here. You know, way back in 2001, I was a Cub reporter, and I was covering the stories of WTO, the TRIPS agreement. And I remember the tone and tenor of media coverage then, including my own stories. We were talking about how India is going to change the way people live the world over. We were the new messiah when it came to medicines. 20 years on, the greatest public health innovation has become one of the biggest swindles in history, they're saying. Medicine Sans Frontier has probably benefited the most from this whole generic pharma industry boom. Many lives have been saved. We've changed the way HIV/AIDS is seen today. Where do you stand on this issue then?
So I think there are two fundamental issues. When you look at what Catherine Ebbing's book, Bottle of Lies, being forward along with Dinesh Thakur, there was a book called Bad Pharma that was published about 12 years ago or 10 years ago that led to a big debate in the European Union about transparency of clinical trial data.
Yes.
And that has fundamentally changed how the European Medicine Agency is now regulating clinical trial data. Now, we can also do the same with this book. We can learn certain lessons. Now, why did MSF at that point of time argue for a WHO pre-qualification system? Because we did realize that medicines that went to developing countries where you had FDAs which were under-resourced, who did not have the ability, for example, like the US FDA, to travel to those countries, we needed a mechanism for proper inspection.
Yeah.
And I think this is fundamentally what we need to ask, is what kind of inspection systems do we have? And I think there's a fundamental merit in asking for no advance warnings for inspections to be conducted by any FDA.
Yeah.
I think if the Indian FDA wants to do inspections on Chinese manufacturers of API, they should be allowed to do so. Similarly, the Indian should reciprocate and provide and allow for inspections to be carried out without advance warning, because obviously there's a merit that is there in advance warning. Number two is this: today, globally, and India is part of it, today, globally, the pharmaceutical industry, we have a crisis vis-a-vis the pharmaceutical industry. It happened with the tobacco industry, it happened with the oil companies, and now it's the global pharmaceutical industry, of which India is a crucial part. What is the big crisis in the pharmaceutical industry? They abuse the patent system. Mm-hmm. They abuse the regulatory system.
Absolutely.
They have abusive pricing systems. They
and this is coming from someone who represents Medicine Sans Frontier, who has gained the most from this.
And I completely agree with what she's saying.
So we are at a point where you have patients in India and the US actually agreeing and bonding that this industry needs proper regulation.
Right.
Our regulators need more independence. Our laws need more teeth. And also, we need to be unstunted by the influence of the industry.
Hmm.
Now, what has the main attention been on the Indian industry? Are you complying with intellectual property laws? How many patents have been granted? Instead, we should have been looking at how we manufacture medicines and how we supply them to the world.
Hmm.
So I would actually say that the 2005 compliance of the World Trade Organization has actually brought all of the attention away towards being compliant on intellectual property, when we should have been compliant on quality.
Mm.
And this is a very big problem with the industry.
Mm.
How many patents have you filed? But they don't answer questions about quality. And I think this is fundamentally, it boils down to how will India's regulators and Indian policymakers treat this book?
Yes.
They can treat it like Bad Pharma and go about doing a proper investigation and go about actually taking some of the points that this book makes, as their own policymakers do. The Indian FDA has just introduced bioequivalence and biostability rules.
Yeah.
Looking at the challenges that the US FDA has faced in getting data on bioequivalence and stability data, how do they envisage going forward? How will they do the inspections? How will they know that the data is not falsified? How can they ensure that they have IT people in the team? So these are the things that I think I would take away from this book.
Okay. Will this be a learning moment for us? But Lina Meghane, what has the experience of Médecins Sans Frontières been in Africa? Because in this book, what Catherine Eban is saying is that the worst drugs, some of them really ineffective, have all been shipped off to African countries. And there are horrific cases that she cited of doctors, including one, a Médecins Sans Frontières doctor from Canada, talking about an experience treating a 13-year-old child who then died. You know, talking about how women giving birth where anesthesia doesn't work, horrific stories. Can you corroborate that? What has Médecins Sans Frontières' experience been like in Africa?
The experience has been that when it came to, you know, where treatment activists got involved and, you know, people living with HIV got involved and, you know, we started to ask for accountability framework, not only on the intellectual property systems that patents shouldn't interfere with life, but we also said that the medicines that are going to be procured through Global Fund, we need a quality mechanism. And that was the WHO pre-qualification system. So in a sense, if you look at it today, if you are looking at HIV medicines or you're looking at tuberculosis medicines, actually there is the system in place. Hmm. But when you talk about other drugs, and this is why Africa is starting to make strides in strengthening its regulatory system.
Yes.
And I think the Africans need to do it for themselves, just as the U.S.
Just as the Indians need to do it for ourselves.
But
okay, Lina Meghane, the basic question here, the broad question here is this an Indian pharma industry problem or was this a one-off? Because, you know, on the other hand, we have Cipla. And Cipla has been fantastic. Cipla's changed the way the HIV epidemic played out in the African continent.
So, as I think Catherine points out, that she actually documented the history of the pharmaceutical industry in the US and in India and what evolved into the regulations. And I think what our experience has been is that it's been positive, but at the same time, sometimes we do have to take action and ask for more data or say that this is not, you know, meeting our standards.
So or positive, but it could have been transformative. It started off as something that would have changed the world, and along the way, something has gone wrong.
It's not gone wrong, it's a process. And I believe that, you know,
it's still a process.
It's still a process. And what has really happened is that the regulatory system is so under-resourced.
Mm.
And, you know, we don't think when something happens, we want independence of the election commission. But we don't talk about independence of regulators at all.
Mm.
And so, you know, whether it's the South Africa MCC or whether it's the Indian regulators or the US FDA, the US FDA had to go out and do these inspections. Why? Because the US government was the biggest pusher of world trade.
Correct.
And they just outsourced everything to everybody. Mm. Local production is absolutely a dirty word at that point of time. And then regulators had to scramble.
Okay.
They have to travel.
Dinesh Dua, please come in over here. These are worrying comments coming in from somebody who is a lawyer for Médecins Sans Frontières, because really this is the organization that has benefited the most by the growth of the Indian generic pharma industry. Otherwise, they would have to buy their medicines from branded companies in the U.S., and they just could not afford it.
Sarah, let me first set the record straight. India is 100% compliant to IPR. As of 2005, a distinction between 31st of December and 1st of January between the process and product patent. So I vehemently disagree on the IPR part. We've won cases, we've lost cases, and we comply all over the world in WTO.
And patents than about the big things that need to be done about public health. This is precisely the problem. More law reform has happened on the patent system than the efforts that we should make on public health. We have to recognize in the developing world that there has
No, I just want to wind up by saying only
no,
one thing.
Can I please
Catherine,
let Dinesh respond.
That has to be
No. So let him finish, and then we're going across to Lina anyway. Go ahead, sir. Finish quickly, please.
I sincerely, honestly, in all admiration of what Catherine has written, invite her to India, work very closely with us, understand the landscape, go into a couple of 6 or 7 mid-sized companies and understand what kind of quality management system and quality by design parameters we've evolved. I personally, in my own company, work with the biggest innovator in the world. And believe you me, our standards at times are better than even the innovators. Having said that, I once again request all stakeholders who are present today to come and be a part of the Indian pharma industry and see as to how much of evolution has taken place over the last one decade.
Leela Meghani, your response.
I think in trying to defend this issue, we are forgetting that one of the biggest concerns has been that we need to strengthen regulatory authorities. And when you say regulatory authorities are all beautifully trained in developing countries, they know their job, they have enough resources. You know, the pharmacovigilance division in India did not receive any funding till very recently. And this is a classical example of, you know, how do you catch when there's a problem with relating to quality of medicines? You look at the pharmacovigilance system. So I'm just simply saying this, that while India is the pharmacy of the developing world, people are actually dependent on generics from China and India. And of course, the fact that, you know, we are looking at a situation where in the context of very high price, more and more people are switching to generics.
Yes.
We do need to recognize that there are certain things that need to be done to complete our entire trust in the regulatory system. Otherwise, why would you have the WHO pre-qualification system in the first place? You have the WHO pre-qualification system in the first place is because we know that some regulatory authorities in the developing world are not able to set up office such as the US FDA.
Okay, I want to go across now to Kabir Chandok and you know, come back to the original question I asked Catherine that worried me, which was that drugs that were not of as good quality were being sold in India as compared to preference given to foreign companies and foreign patients, non-Indians from the first world, for better quality drugs, while we were left to deal with poorer quality drugs. Kabir Chandok has a story. Kabir, what happened to you? Why are you joining us on the show? Why do you want to speak out?
So the thing is that I have no anger against the pharmaceutical industry, because I'm sure that when the person is when the owner or whatever the industry is trying to do something good for the people, but in my case something went wrong. Now what went wrong, I don't know. You are saying that the regulation is in place since 2005. Everything is great, but I was offered a hip joint. It was a metal on metal implant which I had to take care. I had to get my hip joint replaced because of a condition that I suffer from. So at the point when I was offered it, it was really great. It was innovative. It would have been much better for me. And later on, what happened was that, as you said, that gaadiyon ke purjo ko bula lete, you know, you call the car parts back.
So
we are human beings. So we are not percentages over here. 3%, aapne bol diya ke there has been only 3%. So I'm in those 3%, right? So this part was called back, but it was not even called back. When I went again for something else, at that point of time, I was made aware of it. And even after that, it was not a very smooth ride, right? So where did the regulation go wrong in this manner?
But
and
again,
who do
you
I
know,
blame?
Kabir, in your case, again, this Johnson & Johnson hip replacement, this is a well-known fact. It's on public record. It's nothing libelous, defamatory,
right,
anything we're talking about here. But in your case,
no.
This
is
a pharmaceutical multinational, right? So it's not an Indian firm. So it adds to what Mr.
Implant.
Sikka is saying, that this is
That's
the case
true.
Across the board. And whether you're
Absolutely.
A patient in India or a patient in America, patients are the ones who are at the losing end while at the hands of the pharma industry.
Right.
In your case, you
said
that Johnson & Johnson was sending poor quality hip replacers, I'm not sure what the medical term for it is, to the developed world.
Correct.
Yes, this information has come to me also when we were doing a lot of research on this subject, because we've had a long fight against Johnson & Johnson for that matter. This information came to us because 2009 was the year there was a world ban on it. And even after that, there are patients in our patient group where surgeries have happened of the same implant after 2009. Now, how did that happen? World country and all these
things. Mr. Sikka, will we admit to that? The Americans need regulation, as do Indians.
Everybody needs, you know.
Closing argument.
Yes. It's very important that regulations are tightened and tightened more. Of late, it's becoming even more difficult. Dinesh got $50 million for being a whistleblower. There are plenty of them sitting, watching to the last T. And how they make noise, the more noise they make, the more they become popular. Nothing wrong in that. Right. I'm not pointing a finger at him. He's doing his share of good work. The pharmaceutical industry to be tarnished the manner in which it is being done is absolutely putting a slap
on
the
country. That point. Dinesh, your closing argument.
You can attack me for whatever you want. I'm actually speaking from them. Look, when you go buy a cell phone, right, you have two different models. You look at both phones and say, what makes sense for me, for the price, for the functionality. Think about it. When you go to a doctor, do you tell the doctor, I'm going to buy this medicine, this medicine? When you
are cannot.
Please,
the patient cannot. No,
please,
sir.
Please.
This is a wrong example,
Mr.
Slicker, Dinesh.
Mr. Slicker, you had your
cell phone to a medicine. Are you a doctor?
May I please finish my point, sir? The point I'm trying to make here is this, right? As people in the country, demand better accountability from your regulators. Because you are not in the position to make that decision at the time that when you go to a hospital, when you take your mother or your father to a clinic, you're at the most vulnerable situation that you're in. All I'm asking you is, as citizens, demand better accountability from your regulators so that you're not sold a bill of goods that is not what it's supposed to be. That is the only thing I'm saying. Okay? I'm not saying that compare cell phone to a medicine. I'm just trying to understand what I'm trying to say, right?
Dinesh Dua, your closing argument, what can we learn, if anything, and take away from this book that Catherine Ibben has written? We've reached a situation where we're all concerned about the price of drugs, but should we also be concerned about what's in those drugs, the quality of drugs? Closing argument.
I'll give you two data points and to the rest of the panelists as well. In the United States alone, Indian generic companies have helped save the US federal government $265 billion until 2017, and the figure is close to about $300+ billion until 2018. Having said that, in the year 2018 alone, $80 billion worth of savings have been brought about, point number one. In terms of adverse drug reactions, ADR as we call it, the ADR database says that the percentile of Indian generic medicines showing adverse drug reactions is only 0.0245%. How do you explain that? So link the two data points together, and you get to what I'm trying to tell you. Good quality, very economical medicines. India is the pharmacy of the world. It'll remain. And
okay, Catherine Ibben, closing argument to you. I think in the end, the question that everybody who is possibly watching this show will want to ask, what's on their mind is, how do we protect ourselves? What should I take away? If I go into a chemist shop, if I want to buy a medicine for my child who's unwell, what do I need to think about? How has writing this book, researching this book for so long, changed the way you look at medicines? Do you check who the manufacturer is when you buy a medicine for yourself or for your loved ones? Because you're now facing accusations of being a representative of Big Pharma. But on the ground, how has this changed life for you?
First of all, no one is disputing that we need generics and that we need affordable generics. If there's anything that I hope my book accomplishes, we need a global regulatory reform. And people need to understand right now that these drugs, really throughout the world, are largely regulated on an honor system. There is no comprehensive testing of drugs. Almost no regulators do that. Instead, they review company data. In much of the world, pre-announced inspections are the norm, and those are essentially worthless. So there needs to be global regulatory reform. But what consumers particularly need to understand is that just because a drug is on the market does not mean that it is effectively or safely made. And so they need to be vigilant. You know, if you're taking a drug, you need to look at who that manufacturer is. And I tell that to American and to Indian readers. They need to focus, who is the manufacturer? Is that drug working? Are they experiencing side effects? You know, I mean, if a drug is not effective, doctors might be inclined to change a line of treatment, but maybe they need to change the manufacturer. So this is something that people really need to be aware of and focus on and not just assume is effective until really world regulators can figure out how to more effectively
regulate these drugs.
That is
a depressing thought to end on, that when you're sick, the patient has to at the same time also be the doctor, also be the nurse, also evaluate and watch out for how a medicine is how you're reacting to a medicine. But thank you so much, all of you, our panelists, for joining us tonight on what we think is a very important issue for you, our viewer. Thank you for joining us on We the People, where we believe it's important to speak up, but also important to listen. Thank you and good night.